Hey there, this is Laura Kanoy.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
Loretta Allison here. We're having a secret drive.
Oh, so that means...
Shh.
Oh, got it. If you love the exchange, consider a small donation to the station that makes it.
Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in, and we'll send you some secret swag.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope you'll make some noise for the exchange.
Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. No matter what their political persuasion, most experts agree that Social Security faces challenges. And here's the big one. By the year 2035, Social Security will no longer be able to pay full benefits to retirees and others who depend upon it. There's also plenty of agreement about the factors driving this future shortfall, especially that Americans are living longer than ever. But even with this shared vision of the system's problems, agreement on solutions remains harder to reach. Should the wealthy pay more into the system? Or simply forgo benefits? Should the retirement age be raised again? How should the cost of living be adjusted? Here in the Granite State, these questions will be debated tomorrow at a Social Security Summit sponsored by the AARP at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. And today in The Exchange, we get a preview as we ask, what would bring a more secure future for Social Security? Let's hear from you. Your questions about how Social Security works, the health of the program, or your own thoughts on what might improve it are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests with us to talk about this. Romina Baccia is with us. She's a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation with an expertise in Social Security. And Romina, welcome to New Hampshire and welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Max Richman. He's president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. And Max, a big welcome to you, too. Thank you for
your
time.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, both of you, and I'll start with you, Max. I think for many years, policymakers have debated Social Security, what its future should be. A lot of disagreements, as I well understand. But where does almost everybody, Max, agree on this topic?
Well, I'm glad you use the term challenges, that the program faces challenges, because everybody agrees that there are challenges. What not everybody agrees to is that there's a crisis. And sometimes we get caught up in the rhetoric around a crisis, and some would jump to some conclusions and solutions that really don't make sense if you step back and look at the whole picture. It does face challenges. The Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare is a large senior citizen lobbying group. We don't have our heads in the sand. We know there are challenges, and we need to talk about how to address those.
Where is their agreement on what the biggest challenge is?
The biggest challenge is how you continue to the program beyond 2034 at full benefits. As you pointed out, if we don't do anything, just let the program run on automatic pilot, in 2034 there will be a shortfall of about 20%. In benefits. We don't want to see that happen. I don't think anybody wants to see that happen. So as I mentioned, the issue really is how do we address that shortfall? Not a crisis, but that shortfall.
Romina, what do you think?
I do think that there is agreement that we need to prevent automatic and indiscriminate benefit cuts based on the shortfall. But what I'm most concerned about is how do we protect vulnerable retirees from poverty in retirement. And I think the program doesn't do a very a good job of that. Some of our most vulnerable citizens receive inadequate benefits, and others receive very generous benefits that they may not actually need to that extent. So I'd like to look at how can we refocus benefits on the population that we're supposed to help in the first place.
Yeah, and I know that's a big discussion that we'll definitely get into in a minute. You know, that right now everybody gets some kind of a Social Security check when they retire. And the big question has long been, Romina, and as you well know, should super wealthy people, the Warren Buffetts and Ross Perots of the world, get those checks as well? But if you could just clarify for us, Romina, please. So what does it mean when people say Social Security is going to be bankrupt? Social Security is going to run out of money by such and such a time. I mean, what does that really mean?
It really refers to the spending authority. So the Social Security is paid. Social Security benefits are paid on an annual basis based on the payroll taxes that come in from current workers. And then the current cash flow shortfall is made up from trust fund bonds that are stored in the Social Security trust fund. Now, that really is just a debt accounting, and it provides the Social Security with spending authority beyond what's being currently collected from payroll taxes. By 2034, those Treasury securities in the Social Security Trust Fund will be exhausted. So then the Social Security program spending authority is limited to the payroll taxes that come in that year. And there's about a shortfall of about 25%. And the program, because it's supposed to be completely self-funded, is not allowed to continue paying full benefits if there are insufficient payroll taxes to pay for those benefits. The trust fund helps provide the spending authority right now, but we're already facing cash flow deficits. We should be very clear about that.
So right now, there's money coming in from current workers and money going out to current retirees, but there's this trust fund that is helping sort of pad the deficit. Once that trust fund runs out, then there'll only be enough money coming in to pay three quarters of current benefits, roughly.
That's
right.
Is
that correct?
Yes, but it really is just a legal thing because the trust fund doesn't actually hold any real money in it. The way we're currently paying for the cash flow deficit, the difference between payroll taxes and the benefits that are due, is that the federal government borrows that money or it has to come from general revenue taxes. So we're already facing a deficit. The question is just the legality of continuing to pay those deficits once the trust fund's exhausted.
Max, I'd love your thoughts on this, too. It's a little bit complicated for folks because they hear scary headlines like Social Security is bankrupt and it won't be there and it's running out.
That's why I was so happy to hear you refer to it as challenges, because when people hear loaded terms like it's bankrupt, you know, when you hear bankrupt, it's gone. That's not the case. And Romina knows very well that the program, the only way the program could be bankrupt is if we had 100% unemployment and nobody was paying in. Then you'd have a program that was on the verge of bankruptcy. Obviously, it's an overstatement, and I don't think it's helpful to the debate. And I don't think it's quite accurate to say that there are already cash flow problems, because there is interest paid on the bonds that Romina referred to. As long as that interest is paid, you don't have a cash flow problem right now. Here's an example, and here's how I like to explain it, and I think it makes sense. A couple of years ago, when we had enormous unemployment, people weren't paying into payroll tax. There wasn't enough revenue a couple years ago coming in through payroll tax to pay full benefits. But guess what? Everybody got their benefits, full benefits. Why? Because the interest that was accruing on those bonds in the trust fund were paid out, the interest was paid out, and that was available to pay full benefits. So it's not really accurate to say that there's a cash flow problem as long as the program is able to continue and collect interest.
I have a really basic question for both of you. I'll turn to you first, Romina. How is my Social Security paycheck going to be calculated? What's it going to be based on?
So it is based on your highest average earnings over 35 years of employment. First, in order to qualify for any benefit, you have to have earned above a certain level for at least 10 years. That's how you become vested in the program. And then when we calculate your initial benefit at your retirement age, which in your case might be 66 or 67 because it's slowly going up, Social Security looks at how much did you earn over your 35 highest earning years, and then it's adjusted for wage growth in the economy. So you get a little bump up based on and productivity increases that have happened since. And that defines your initial benefit, which then annually gets adjusted for increases in the cost of living.
So, Max, wealthier people who make more over their lifetimes pay in more, but they also get more back.
That's correct.
Is that fair?
Well, I think it is. And I think it really goes to the heart of the debate about the future of Social Security. And you mentioned in your opening, should wealthy people Warren Buffett. I happen to be from Omaha.
Where Warren Buffett is from.
Yeah. And he lives about a mile from where I grew up. Unfortunately, my family didn't take any of his investment advice or things would have turned out a little different. But at any rate, Warren Buffett didn't know he was going to be the Oracle of Omaha back in the 50s and the 60s. That's the point. People, when you're working, you're paying into this program. And what are you buying? You're buying insurance. You know, we know the term FICA. How many people know what FICA stands for? I know Romina knows. Federal Insurance Contribution Act. It's insurance and funds old age survivor and disability programs.
So that's the Social Security tax, basically.
Yeah, you're buying insurance in the event that a worker dies young. There are survivor benefits. There are benefits for children, surviving spouses, and a program that's there for someone when that person retires. So it's insurance, and that's why it's important to keep everybody within the program and not to start defining beneficiaries based on their wealth.
I have one more quick question about how this works, and then we should definitely get into some of those policy debates, Max, that you raise. Romina, for you again, so you talked about how my check, for example, will be calculated once I retire. What about those many Americans who don't pull in a regular weekly paycheck, especially stay-at-home moms and dads who are working hard, raising the next generation, but aren't necessarily drawing a regular paycheck? What about those folks?
Well, if they don't earn a certain amount every quarter, then they don't accrue Social Security credits for those quarters. However, because the Social Security system only looks at 35 years of earnings, you can have, you know, several years with no earnings because you're in college or because you're raising a family, and you could still potentially accrue 35 years of earnings. Now, if you fall short of those 35 years, then any year, say you only work 30 years at the required level and 5 years not, then those count as zero earning years, which reduces your Social Security benefit. And that's why especially the older generation of women who tended to stay at home, and if they weren't married for at least 10 years, so they would qualify for spousal benefits, they have lower benefits at times because they didn't work for the required 35 years.
Well, and that's why there's a lot of attention right now on Social Security and its implications, especially for women. And we'll definitely talk about that. Let me invite our listeners to join us as well. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at Social Security and its fiscal future. Our guests are two national experts who are in New Hampshire this week for a forum on this topic at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics tomorrow. You can find out more about that event on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, or you can join us right now with a phone call at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email that just came in from Tom in Exeter. He says, years ago, did Congress take money from Social Security? And if so, did they pay it back, including interest? Romina, do you know?
So this is actually a complicated question. So
lots of stuff around Social Security, as I've learned, is complicated.
So the federal government doesn't have a policy of saving. So over the 20-year period after the 1983 Social Security reforms, where the payroll tax was increased, the Social Security program ran surpluses. That money was just added to general revenues. It ended up reducing the reported deficit. And we know now, based on economic research, that Congress did indeed spend all those funds, and it fueled the growth in the size of government because the Social Security surpluses reduced the reported deficit, which made it look like the federal government was in a better fiscal state, and so other program expansions occurred. However, all of that money that Congress spent was credited to the Social Security Trust Fund in the form of an IOU. So that is just like any Treasury security that people have bought. It is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, just like any other government debt. Now, recently, actually, during the Great Recession, there was a brief period where the payroll tax on the employer side was reduced because it was believed that it would encourage more hiring at the time when we had very high unemployment levels. And a policy was passed where that revenue shortfall from reducing the payroll tax temporarily was made up with general revenue infusions into the Social Security Trust Fund. So all of the taxes that were paid were credited to the Social Security Trust Fund. And yes, the money was spent. And so now, in order to pay full benefits, whether it's paying interest on those bonds or eventually having to trade those bonds in for actual cash to pay benefits, that does come from taxpayers today or from additional borrowing.
Well, Tom, thanks for the email. And Max, when about did this happen? Because I'm remembering the campaign of 2000 and Al Gore talking about a Social Security lockbox. Is that what this is about?
Well, Romina is correct. It's a complicated subject, and I don't think it's helpful to refer to these government bonds as IOUs, because when most people hear IOUs, and I've heard politicians talk about them and characterize these bonds, as Romina says, that have the full faith and credit of the United States government backing them, as scraps of paper. These aren't little scraps of paper with Max Richman written on it. These are government bonds that are backed by the government. So, you know, yes, the money was used. It would not make sense. I remember Al Gore talking about the lockbox. I remember it being parodying on Saturday Night Live. You probably remember that too, the lockbox. But it would not make sense to have $2.9 trillion, which now has been accrued in the trust fund, sitting in a box.
So the lockbox was not a good idea, even though it sounded good.
It sounded good, but you want that money to earn some interest. So it's invested in government bonds, backed by the government. It has always been repaid. These bonds are rolled over almost on a daily basis. Interest is accrued and paid back to the Social Security program. It is the safest investment possible in these government bonds. So, you know, it is complicated. You know, I was at a town hall meeting not long ago, and the trust fund had $2.7 trillion. And I said to the group, you want this money to earn interest. You wouldn't want to have $2.7 trillion under your mattress. And a man in the back said, yes, I would. But this program makes sense because of the way it's structured.
Romina, go ahead, and then we'll go to our listeners.
I think another way of thinking about the lockbox issue is to think about getting the money out of the hands of Congress and their endless appetite for spending. We're $19 trillion in debt, and about $2.8 trillion of that debt is debt that we owe to the Social Security Trust Fund. The lockbox could be structured in the form of private accounts. So just like your 401k or IRA that are defined contribution accounts that you own, that you can invest, where you can actually earn higher returns than you can earn on government bonds, which is the only way that Social Security is allowed to be invested currently. That is the idea of the lockbox. You own it. Congress can't touch it. So you know it'll be there when you retire, which is not the case now.
So is that making the case, Romina, for quote-unquote privatizing Social Security? Because that's a hot one.
No, I think that people really value that security of an annuity, a guaranteed lifetime income. But I think that should not replace most of individuals' retirement income. It should act as a basic safety level to keep people out of poverty. But beyond that, I think most Americans are much better served by private retirement accounts that they own, that they can invest, that they can pass on to their children, money that they own that Congress can't touch. So I think we should reduce the role of Social Security as part of the retirement package. I think too many people rely solely on Social Security and instead provide a basic level of safety and allow people to invest the funds otherwise in private accounts.
There's been a lot of discussion about how, you know, and I've heard people say we rely too much on Social Security, but people have fewer options these days. You know, old-fashioned pensions aren't around anymore. There's just savings accounts aren't what they used to be. So in this era, there's actually fewer options for people to make those investments that you talk about.
So in some ways, there are actually more options. You have IRAs, you have now automatic enrollment retirement accounts, and you do see much greater growth potential in those areas. Now, you do want to have protection in case you're retiring when there's a market downturn. I think Social Security can play that role very well. But beyond that, I think people are much better served by accounts that they own, where they can take advantage of the economic growth as well.
All right. We'll talk a lot more about that in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Social Security and its fiscal future. Our guests are two national experts. They're in New Hampshire this week for a forum on the topic. It'll be held at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics tomorrow. You can find out more on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can give us a call now. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Romina Baccia, a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation with an expertise in Social Security. Also with us, Max Richman. He's president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. And before we go to our listeners, both of you, Max, I did want to give you a chance to jump in also on this idea that Romina brought to the table that many people have talked about before, let folks invest a segment or a portion of their Social Security funds into private accounts.
Yes,
what do you think?
I think it's great to let people invest on top of their Social Security, and some people do. But to replace part of this really meager benefit, on average, a woman receives about $1,100 a month, and a man about $1,400 a month. To replace part of the Social Security with a private investment account, I think would be a mistake. Now, Romina talks about, she's worried about the endless appetite of the federal government for this the money that's paid into the program. Frankly, I and a lot more folks around the country are more worried about the endless appetite of Wall Street, who's so eager to get into this program, to have people invest their savings in accounts on Wall Street. Yes, sometimes you can get a better return. Sometimes you can get a worse return. If you retired in 2007 and 8 and 9 and you're counting on your private investment, my 401k at our organization, which we have for our employees, I started calling it my 201k. Lost about half its value. So, you know, I think it's fine to encourage investment, to help people understand how to invest, but we don't need to put this program that is so essential, does not provide lavish benefits, at risk by investing any of that money in Wall Street.
Romina, can you address that, this nervousness that some people have that, you know, if you retire in 2007 or at various points when the stock market's down, you're out of luck? And also that a suspicion that this push to privatize is being driven by, you know, people on Wall Street who would stand to gain.
Yeah. So I'd like to refer people to New Zealand. We actually just had a Kiwi born at the Washington, D.C. Zoo. And there's a program in New Zealand called Kiwi Saver. And what New Zealand does is they provide a predictable, guaranteed retirement benefit for individuals. But then they also have a second-tier system of automatic enrollment IRAs. They are regulated. The funds are put in target date retirement funds. So the closer an individual gets to retirement, the more conservative that investment portfolio becomes. So when you have a market crash like we saw in 2008, individuals near retirement wouldn't have a very large portion anymore in the stock market. Most of their retirement savings would be in the form of bonds. But over their 40, 50-year working lives, they would have been able to take advantage of the growth in the economy by having more more in stocks. And the idea is that, yes, it's very scary when the market tanks like it did in 2008, but those kinds of market downturns only happen so very often. And the market has come back up and is now above the levels where it was at before the market crashed. So whenever we're thinking about investment, we have to take a long view. I have 30 more years until retirement, so I can have a more aggressive portfolio. But somebody who's in their 50s should probably buy more bonds and less stocks in order to make sure that if there's a downturn while they're trying to retire, it doesn't affect them as heavily.
Let's go to our listeners, both of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Join us with your questions, comments, concerns about Social Security, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go first to Alex in Rochester. Hi, Alex. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I find the show interesting and relevant to my personal life. I'm a disabled adult. I'm 46 years old now. I've been a lifelong New Hampshire resident. I became disabled when I was 24 and officially considered disabled by Social Security at the age of 24. And I currently depend on Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSDI, as well as SSI, which is Supplemental Security Income from Social Security. My total monthly income from SSDI and SSI from Social Security is $753 a month.
Wow, it's not very much, Alex.
It's not, and even when you add in, I'm on food stamps as well, even when you add in food stamps, which is like $49 a month, my total monthly income is only $802. Now, that's not unusual. I'm not unique. Because I became disabled at a young age, I don't receive much because I didn't pay much into the system before I became disabled. How is that fair to me when I'm just as much a citizen as anyone else, yet I have to eat at soup kitchens at the end of every month to get by?
Wow, and Alex,
One more quick comment.
Sure, go ahead.
My total annual income is over $2,000 below the federal poverty threshold.
And well, let me get our guests in on this. And thank you so much for calling. And I'm sorry to hear about your struggles. Wow, that's a young age to have to rely on Social Security. Max, to you first, please. He's right. You know, Social Security gives back what you put in. Unfortunately, he has this disability, so he hasn't been able to put in that much. So he's not getting that much back and living below the poverty line through, he says, no fault of his own.
Well, as I mentioned, Social Security, the Social Security program is insurance. In the event that you do become disabled, a worker becomes disabled, there are benefits for that person, for survivors, and for children. We have been trying for a number of years to change the dynamic, the discussion from cut, 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 which was what we hear from many, many quarters, including Heritage, to talk about expanding the program for people like that caller and for many people in a similar situation. And fortunately, we've now changed the discussion, and there is a lot of momentum to expanding Social Security, improving the minimum benefit, having a more accurate measure of inflation so that there will be a COLA. You know, in 2016, the COLA is zero.
COLA means the cost of living adjustment.
Cost of living adjustment. 2010 and 11, it was zero. You will not find a single beneficiary of Social Security that will say, well, the cost of living didn't increase for me in 2010 or 11 or 2016. The measurement, the calculation is flawed and needs to be changed. So we need to talk about expanding benefits, improving the minimum benefit, having a credit for caregivers. We talked early in the program about how many people, particularly women, leave the workforce to raise a family, to care for an elderly parent, and they lose. Yes, they still can get Social Security based on a computation that will reduce their benefits. We need to have a formula that will implement a credit for those years. And we need to, and thankfully, just yesterday, the president was giving a speech, I believe, in Indiana, and for the first time that I recall, he started talking about expanding Social Security.
Well, that's,
we're moving in the right direction.
And getting back to Alex's point and your first point in response, Max, too, we need to expand Social Security. If the value of the program and the success of the program is based on the idea that it's an insurance program, you pay in, you get back, is Social Security really the right vehicle for people like Alex? Or in those situations, since he didn't have the opportunity to pay into this insurance program, should he get help from other programs? Social Security perhaps is not the right vehicle to help him out.
Well, he may well be getting help from other programs. There may be, I don't know what state programs there are here in New Hampshire, but he may well be getting help from other sources. But I'm talking about a basic floor for survival. And yes, $700 a month or $800, whatever he mentioned, not very much money, very hard to get by on. That's why, again, we need to improve the minimum benefits. We need to have an accurate cost of living adjustment every year. And I'm hoping that now that we have legislation in the Senate, in the House, Senator Sanders, in the Democratic primary, both Senator Sanders and Secretary Clinton have been talking more and more about improving benefits in various ways, and I hope we can talk about how more revenue can be brought into the program to do just that and extend the solvency.
Yeah, there are lots of ideas out there that I would love to talk about, including raising the retirement age, how to calculate inflation, as you hinted at, Max. But since we're talking about this idea of people who are on disability receiving Social Security benefits, and that's a lot of people, right, Romina? I mean, that's like a third of Social Security beneficiaries are not retirees. Is that correct?
It's about 11 million people that are on the Social Security Disability Insurance Program. And that is actually the one Social Security program that is real insurance. It targets individuals who are unable to work due to a disability. And it is also at least earnings tested. So individuals on the disability program are only allowed to earn about $850 a month, which is referred to as the substantial gainful activity level. So those individuals with this disability who can supplement their benefits can do so to a limited level. But this is actually one of the areas, I think, where we might find some common agreement. I think in order for Social Security, the retirement and the disability program to act as real insurance, it ought to provide at least poverty level benefits to keep people out of poverty. But we do also have to think about how we pay for this without imposing undue tax burdens on current workers or undue debt burdens on younger generations. And I think that's where we'd like to refocus benefits away from upper income retirees that can do with a lower benefit or that may not need benefits at all, and to make sure that people like Alex, who have become disabled at a very young age and who are living below the federal poverty level now, at least have that above poverty level benefit. So we envision a system where you have a predictable guaranteed benefit that keeps everyone who's insured under the Social Security programs out of poverty. But then in order to pay for that, we would reduce benefits for individuals with high levels of non-Social Security income in retirement.
So, Romina, it sounds like you're agreeing with Max that the program could do a better job by people like Alex and who are, you know, in financial difficulty. I guess the disagreement is where you find the money to do that. Got another question here from a listener on a similar topic. Sarah in Freedom says, can your guest comment on the increasing number of Social Security disability claims? Sarah says, I'm a financial planner, and in the past few years, I've seen a big increase in the number of Social Security disability claims that have been approved for clients who would have historically been declined. Sarah asks, does this affect the funding of the program? Romina, you want to take that one first?
So the disability insurance program has its own funding stream. It gets a portion of the payroll tax that's separate from the retirement program. However, it did face a shortfall in 2016, and Congress passed a patch in 2015, actually reallocating money from the Social Security retirement program toward the disability program. So that did happen. Some of the increase in the roles in the disability program are due to the aging of society. So some of them are expected, but about half of the increase in recent years is unexplained. And some of that has to do with what are called the grid factors. That's basically if you're 45 years and older and you do not speak English, even if you live in Puerto Rico, where Spanish is the primary language of business, you have an easier time getting into the disability program than somebody who's, say, 38. If you're 55 and older and you're fluent in English, you also face laxer criteria to get into the program. Even if your disability by itself doesn't qualify you, in combination with your age, there's no longer the expectation that you would retrain or get another job. So if you can't perform the work, then you can get in more easily. I think there's a lot of problems with the disability program, and also that people are staying on the rolls even if their condition has improved. And we have a number of reforms that we recommend to make sure that those individuals who truly need those benefits because they are unable to work and they haven't recovered from their disability, the benefits are there for them. But we shouldn't discourage people from going back to the workforce, and we should try to make sure that people who have recovered go back to work.
Well, lots more to talk about on this particular slice of the Social Security system. Sarah, thank you for the email. Alex, thank you for the call, and good luck to you. And we've got a lot of people who have other questions, so I do want to move on to them. And let's go to Derry, where Peter is on the line. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I understand the person, I believe you're from the Heritage Foundation, that the argument about people should privatize Social Security. But most people, when they have an opportunity to put away savings of their own, they don't put away anywhere near enough. Currently, you pay approximately 9% of your salary, and your employer matches 9% of the salary to put away funds for a Social Security benefit. And yet, if people are not putting it away in at current returns of a fraction of a percent, there is no way that individual funds could provide for any kind of comfort and security.
So, Peter, some concern about privatization, and I want to add in an email from Nathan, who also says, an emphatic no to the idea of private accounts your guest just brought up. The replacement of pensions with 401ks shows that this is a disaster. Most people don't know what to invest in, and the supposed gains are mostly eaten by Wall Street. So, Peter, thanks for the call, and Nathan for the email. And we talked about this earlier, but Romina, I do want to give you a chance to jump in, and then I have a couple more questions for both of you.
So I think that what we find is that low-income people have a tougher time saving for retirement in addition to Social Security, because Social Security consumes 12.4% of their paycheck. So there isn't much left to set aside for retirement. Wealthier individuals face a number of tax benefits, and they do put away a lot more money for retirement, and Social Security therefore also is less necessary for them. But to the question of how do we make sure that people actually put that money away for their retirement? I think there are ways that we can help people. We're using the insights of behavioral economics. People are sometimes short-sighted. They know what their needs are today, and they may not think about that they might live to 85 or 90 years even, and what their needs will be in retirement. So that's where the idea of the automatic enrollment IRA comes in. It puts everyone in the program at an automatic deduction, and then the individuals who wanted to make different financial plans, who want to plan for their retirement, say, by building a business or investing in real estate, doing something different than the target date retirement funds, they could take their money out and do that. But the vast majority, about 85%, based on other countries that have adopted this system, would likely stay in those accounts. And because those accounts actually accrue gains based on growth in the economy, people would end up with much larger funds than they can get from Social Security today, and they would also have to set aside less, so they'd have more money available to put towards their homes or a business or their kids' education.
Max, I got to let you jump in here too. And what about other countries? This isn't a totally crazy, untested idea. Other countries have turned to some measure of privatization.
Some have. There are the reports on the impact vary quite a bit. But I do want to jump in and comment on a couple of points that Romina made. Yes, there are some people that have abused the disability program. A program that large, you will always find a few egregious cases. And unfortunately, those are the ones that receive a lot of publicity. But if you talk to people who have applied for disability, it is not easy. It takes a long time. The appeals process takes years. There are so many people around the country, and I wish Heritage would talk to some of them, who need disability who can't get on the program because it is so strict and difficult to apply and to receive benefits.
Max, I'm going to cut you off there, but I will let you pick it up, I promise, okay, after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Social Security, its fiscal troubles and possible solutions. Our guests are two national experts who were in the state this week for a forum on the program's future being held at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics tomorrow. If you want more information on that, you can go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Let's hear from you now. Join our conversation with your questions, comments, concerns. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Max Richmond, go ahead. I had to interrupt you to head into the break there.
I just wanted to make one other observation on Romina's point about people that don't need Social Security shouldn't be getting it.
Wealthier people who have paid in.
That's the point. They paid in. They didn't know they were going to be wealthy. They were buying insurance. God bless them. They did well. But they did pay into the program. You know, I have had meetings with members of Congress who self-righteously say, I don't need Social Security. I shouldn't be getting it. And I've said to a couple of them, they didn't like this. I said, you don't need to get it. You can go on the SSA website, fill out a form. It'll take about 5 minutes. If you feel that it's that wrong for you to be getting your benefits, you don't have to get them.
There is a way for you to go in and say, I'm wealthy, I don't need this, here, take it back.
Of course, and some people do that. And if anybody that's listening that has that much money, please do it so we can have more money for the rest of us. But the reason Social Security is supported by overwhelming majorities, and we've done polling for years, 85% of Democrats, almost that many Republicans, almost that many independents support the program, want it to be continued, want it to expand. And, you know, Heritage and others should start listening to what the American people want, not what Wall Street wants.
Well, so you're saying that don't change it into a quote-unquote welfare program where it's based on need.
Exactly.
Keep it a strict insurance program. So how do you, though, then, Max, pull in the extra funds to help people like Alex, our caller, like the people that Romina referred to, you know, who are really in desperate situations?
First of all, it's not a welfare program, and it shouldn't become a welfare
program. No, I know. I understand
that. But let me just say, I have asked audiences how many of you are on Social Security. My audience is almost everybody is. Anybody ashamed to be on Social Security? No. Anybody would be proud to be on welfare? No. We don't want this program to become a welfare program. How do you bring more revenue in? We talked during the break about the cap, a cap on wages subject to the FICA tax, the payroll tax. It is $118,500 a year. After that, no more Social Security tax. Now, a lot of people don't even know that because they've never approached the cap. So they assume you pay payroll tax on all your wages.
Which is 6.2%
on each side, the employer and the employee. Let me just use one of the most egregious examples that someone emailed me a couple weeks ago. LeBron James. I hate to pick on LeBron. He's a terrific ball player, basketball player. But he stops paying payroll tax halfway through the first quarter of the first game of the entire season. The rest of that quarter, the rest of the game, the playoffs, the championship, no more payroll tax. Does that make sense?
So no. Let's super clarify it for people. So let's say I make $200,000, which I do not. But let's just say I do. I'm paying Social Security tax, Max, on the first $118,000. After that, I'm not paying in. You're saying one way to bring in big bucks for this program is to make people pay that full Social Security tax on their full income.
There are a couple ways. You can either do that, just lift the cap, eliminate it, or you can maintain the cap at the level it's at. It goes up a little bit each year, and reinstitute the payroll tax at $250,000. That politically is probably easier because you're not going to impact what some might consider middle-class taxpayers. Senator Sanders has had legislation that would do just that. Congressman John Larson's got about 80 co-sponsors. He's a congressman from Connecticut. There's a bill in the counterpart in the Senate that Senator Blumenthal has. Starts it at $400,000. So you bring more revenue in, you can expand the benefits, improve the minimum benefit, have a more accurate and fair cost of living adjustment, add almost 40 years to the solvency.
And Romina, I want to get you in on this, but before I do, there's another voice that I want to bring into our conversation. Joining us now on the phone is Christina Martin-Fervita. She's Director of Government Affairs for AARP, which is organizing this tour that Romina and Max are part of on the future of Social Security. Christina, welcome to The Exchange. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Well, on your website, right up front, you say Social Security needs to be updated for the 21st century. Christina, what does that mean, updated?
So I think what that means is we and our members and as Max pointed out, just most everyone that you meet, we're either all paying into Social Security while we're working or we're eventually collecting Social Security. So for everyone, it's been a vital program for the last 80 years. We know it's going to need to be updated so that it can continue to be such a strong program for the next 80 years. And some of the reasons it needs updating are what you're hearing Romina and Max talk about. We're going to need to find some ways to bring more resources into the program or look at the benefits. Max wants to expand benefits. Romina has some ideas about where to maybe cut them back. Those are all changes that need to be looked at. We need to have a good debate, an honest debate, not a debate of just sound bites and folks taking a position and not really having a dialogue if we're going to secure the future for this program and make sure that it's there for our kids and grandkids, so just the way it's been there for our own parents.
What specific policies would AARP like to see, Christina, as part of this updating, again, to use your word?
Sure. So AARP has always been a champion for Social Security, and we have absolutely taken some strong positions in the past. But right now, what we're focused on is not so much taking any specific policy position, but trying to get the candidates, and especially presidential candidates, to lay out plans and for them to take positions. And our thinking is, you know, the next president of the United States very likely is someone who's going to have to address some of these changes in Social Security. And the voters deserve to know what the candidates think about the program, what they want to do to secure the future of the program. And that's why we've been working so hard to get everyone to talk about this issue during the election. Now, we're down just to the last few candidates, but we were, as you know, in New Hampshire, we were very involved in talking to all of the campaigns. When we had many, many more candidates, we had over 100 events. We had a lot of volunteers talking to the candidates. And we did some polling showing that the public really wanted to see Social Security as not only an important policy issue that needed to be addressed in the election, but even just as a sign of leadership. 9 out of 10 individuals that we polled thought that it was a sign of presidential leadership to be honest with the public, to tell the public what a candidate wanted to do with Social Security, and that was something voters were looking for in a candidate.
So you don't want to take specific positions this time, it sounds like, Christina. Your AARP is kind of saying we're agnostic on this issue in terms of some of the policies or what?
To clarify, sure. No, I appreciate that follow-up. To clarify, it's not that we are agnostic. It's that we understand that we're in an important presidential election cycle. We're at the end of two terms, and so we're obviously going to need to make a fresh choice. There's not going to be an incumbent, and that means there's going to be a lot of ideas out there, a lot of names out there for voters to choose from. And voters want and deserve to know what does a candidate think the program should look like. When they're voting, they deserve to know what is likely to happen to the program under a particular person's leadership. And we know that the most important thing that we can do right now, this year in 2016, is to encourage candidates to talk about Social Security, to be honest with the public about what they want to do with the program, to secure presidential leadership and also congressional will. If we're going to be able to update the program, we're going to need both members of Congress who are willing to have an honest dialogue and presidential leadership. And so that's what we're really focused on in 2016.
And as much as probably most listeners appreciate that and say, yes, I want to know where candidates for Congress and Senate and president stand, To be quite honest, Christina, Social Security is often called, as you know, the third rail of politics. Touch it and you die. Is it more realistic to expect people to be honest about this after the election? It seems sometimes when they try to be honest before the election, their thoughts get twisted and it's used against them in attack ads.
Well, I think we're trying very hard to be transparent through our campaign, Take a Stand. We have a website, takeastand.org, to make sure that everyone is hearing from their candidates. We're not trying to judge plans. We've had, coming back to positions we've taken in the past, certainly positions we've very vigorously taken in the past. We've opposed some ideas for Social Security that we saw at least one presidential candidate put back on the table. I'm like, talking about privatization.
Yes, that's what I thought. Go ahead.
We were happy to report to anyone who visited our website that, a particular presidential candidate was interested in this idea again. And we did not say in our website, we disagree with this candidate. So we ourselves are trying to model the behavior of, look, everyone, it's too late after you voted for someone to find out what they really think about the single most important program that we can think of, and one that just about everyone participates in. People deserve to know before they vote. And if we're going to encourage candidates to be honest, we do have to hold our fire and not say, well, that's not an idea we agree with, or that's not an idea that's going to work. We need to let every candidate have the space to be able to say what they honestly think are their best policy views. And we need to let the voters decide what sounds best to them.
Okay. Well, Christina, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it. And good luck as you roll out this event. As I understand, you're holding it in almost half a dozen states. So thank you.
Yes, we're really excited. And thank you, Max and Romina. We'll see you tomorrow for this event.
Thank you so much.
That's Christina Martin Fervita, again, Director of Government Affairs for AARP. And Romina, I did want to give you a chance also to jump in on this very interesting concept of the cap. Max explained it very well, that up to almost $120,000 of income, you pay this tax, everybody pays the same amount. But after that, you're kind of scot-free. I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, so the reason the tax cap exists is because benefits are earnings-related. So if we credited wealthier individuals with all of the additional taxes they would pay above the tax cap, we would have to pay them outrageous annual benefits, like $150,000 a year, which seems excessive for a federal insurance program. So some proposals say, no, let's just make them pay, but don't give them additional credits, which in effect is turning it already into a welfare program. The other thing to keep in mind is that other countries, some people might consider them larger welfare states than the United States, like Germany, where I'm actually from, the tax cap is capped at 1.5 times the average wage. In the U.S., the tax cap is actually about 3 times the average wage. So it's not like our tax cap is very low. In fact, it's much, much higher than earnings-related retirement systems have their tax caps in other countries. It would be a massive tax increase. If we were to get rid of the tax cap altogether, I think we should lower the rate that people have to pay. Because ultimately, the question we need to ask is, how much of the economy should this federal program be allowed to consume? When we talk about benefit enhancements, and I think they're important, especially for vulnerable populations, we also need to keep in mind where the money comes from. It comes from American workers and the very wealthiest individuals. Most of their income isn't earnings related, so the payroll tax wouldn't even touch that income if it comes from capital assets, from real estate, or from stock portfolios and trust funds. That money is not taxed under the payroll tax. So I think that we shouldn't lift the payroll tax cap. If anything, we should reduce it and refocus benefits so they keep people who truly need the benefits out of poverty, do so with better adequacy than today, and allow wealthier individuals to plan for their own retirement, which they're already doing.
So just to make it crystal clear, you're saying if we raise the cap and taxed all income, all wages under Social Security, whether you make $120,000 or $60,000 or $300,000, that those folks making $300,000 would then say when they retired, look, I paid in all this money, and so now I'm expecting a big payout.
Well, that's already the case. People expect to receive benefits from the program because everyone had to pay in. But the benefits are capped at the amount of taxes that they had to, you know, the tax cap exists because the benefit is earnings related, like we talked about the formula before. But I do think if we eliminate the cap, then we ought to lower the rates. Instead of 12.4%, people ought to pay in a lot less.
What do you think, Max? You're shaking your head over there.
Well, I am. It's almost going to fall off. I'm shaking it so hard. It's really a specious argument to say if you lift the cap, you're going to have to pay beneficiaries that would pay that much more. A huge amount of money. You don't have to do that. The Congress can do whatever it chooses. You can change the formula. You could change the percentage of the payroll tax. You can change the formula so that people that pay a lot more should receive some more in benefits. But it does not have to be proportional. And the formula can be adjusted in any way that the Congress and a president decide to do it. So, you know, we shouldn't be caught. I don't think it's helpful to get caught up in arguments that discourage consideration of some reasonable proposals. And I think lifting the cap is a way, or beginning payroll taxes to be collected after a certain level of income is a way to bring more money in. I'll bet you if Heritage did some surveys, they would find overwhelming majorities support a program that would bring more revenue into Social Security that is fair to beneficiaries and is fair to taxpayers.
I have to ask
but
you both.
How do we protect that additional money from Congress? Congress spent all the surplus revenues when we had surpluses over 20 years. The money is gone.
Congress
if we
doesn't
lift
spend
the payroll
it. They, bar-
tax
they borrow it, and it's always repeat. Congress doesn't
spend
it.
Yes, but we have to pay those debts. Congress doesn't pay those debts.
I have one more question, and we haven't even gotten into the whole how do you measure inflation, and that's a whole other issue that we don't have time to get into. What about, we have like 30 seconds left. I'm sorry to do this to both of you. But Romina, what about raising the retirement age? It's already going up. What is it at now? 67 and a half? Or?
It's about 66 now, and it will go up to 67 by about 2024. Increasing the retirement age is actually a common sense bipartisan proposal because what we're doing now is people live longer, but they don't pay taxes for Social Security longer. They just draw benefits for longer. So that is one of the primary reasons why we're seeing the shortfall and the insolvency looming by 2034. And by raising the retirement age, we do focus benefits on those who need them the most, which are all our older workers who can no longer work.
You know, living longer does not necessarily mean you can work longer. And that's a faulty premise. Yes, Ramin and I hopefully can do these kinds, and you as the host can do these kinds of programs for years beyond 67, which will be retirement age will be for everyone soon. But there are many jobs where you cannot, millions and millions of jobs, you cannot continue to work if you have a job.
Well, we have to end it at that, and I'm so sorry that we have to, but I want to thank both of you very much for coming in, and again, welcome to New Hampshire.
Thanks for
being
us.
Here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.